this morning, I'm going to talk about Augustine. I spoke about Thomas Aquinas last week, and when I spoke about Thomas, I mentioned that, in my view anyway, the two greatest theologians of all time were Thomas and another person. It happens to be Augustine. And I can't decide which one I favor. I think it's whichever one I'm reading at the time. You see how fickle I am. But there is one thing, at least, that Protestants, Reformed folk on the one hand, and Catholics do agree on. And that is that Augustine of Hippo Regius was the greatest saint since Paul. And I've not heard of any who differ from that in those two camps, those two combative camps. Protestants and Catholics do agree about this. The greatest saint since the Apostle Paul himself. Augustine, he would later reach the elevation of bishop within the church in the west of Hippo Regius, which is in North Africa, modern-day Algeria. Annaba is the town, as it's called now, under the Arabs and the Muslims. Back then it was not that. It was a Roman province of Numidia, North Africa, near where Rommel used to run around, Desert Fox, in that area, right on the upper part of Africa there, near the Mediterranean. Old Carthaginian territory. In fact, Hippo, the word, derives from the Punic language of the Carthaginians, meaning harbor, and this means royal harbor. It's distinguished from another harbor just down the road, right? It's another harbor. So it's from the old Punic. Carthage, ancient city, is nearby to the east. To the west of Hippo Regius is Augustine's hometown of Thagasta. There, he's the son of one Roman minor official, actually sort of a town councilor in Thagaste, a man named Patricius, whose very name means father. His father, named Father Patricius. His mother, the famous Monica, known for her famous dream about her son and her desire for his salvation. We'll get to that in a moment. But Patricius and Monica, just as an aside right quick, in modern-day universities and in departments of African-American studies, there's a doctrine called Afrocentrism, which tries to co-opt certain great ones for their own. They tried to do this with Cleopatra to no avail, because she was actually Greek, descended from Alexander. So no score there. Right, she was not even Egyptian, and they, in fact, the Egyptians of classical times were not Negroid as well. So doubly wrong about that. Analogous to that, they tried to co-opt the great Augustine. Well, it doesn't work there either, because Patricius was from Rome, clearly a Caucasian, and Monica was a Berber, again, a Caucasoid. Right, so just as an aside, just to put that one to bed, put that one to rest, that's Augustine. Now, before I dive into the particular topic, which is the fall of man and how it changed our image. What do I mean by that? How it broke the image of God in us. So man fractured and broke the image of God through his own bad choice, the first man, and we all inherit that sin, original sin. I'm going to break it down into the particular aspects of that image, of the nature of man, man's mind, man's soul. We're going to talk about the different faculties of man and how they were affected by this fall. I'm not going to address the question of how the fall came about. That's another very big issue. We can go back to people like Leibniz and Augustine and others, talk about that. That's a separate issue right now. Or in a little bit, we're going to talk about what happened to your particular faculties. What happened to your emotions, to your reason, to your imagination? What happened to you, and that calls for an act of imagination to find out what was original man like before the fall. That's a huge question. Huge. Extreme. Nothing is more important when we're dealing with human affairs than getting to the bottom of the fall of man. Nothing's more important. Now, a bit, I'm going to back up and talk a bit about Augustine and his life and what led him into the faith. As a young man, he was a troubled young man. He really was. There was stealing, there was theft, there were jealousies. He recounts this in his work called Confessions, which is an extraordinary thing we'll talk about in a moment. Unlike any other book that had been written up to that time, the Confessions, when a man finally, in a work, a published work, referred to himself as a particular man. You say, well, that's odd. That's strange. People do that all the time now. The bookstore is full of books about myself. In fact, we're ultra focused on ourselves, right? We're fixated on it. We're obsessed with self. Not so before that. People used to write in third person about the nature of man. The nature of man, always this distance. But with Augustine, it became personal. Augustine will write the first autobiography. The first autobiography is the Confessions. He's talking about himself and his struggle with sin and his salvation. It's extremely personal if you've read the Confessions. Very personal. He's talking about his lust as a young man. He was a skirt chaser. He was a woman chaser. He had a peasant wife, not even a wife, girlfriend, he was shacked up with for years, right, and finally tossed her to the side. There were things he did. He stole out of a neighbor's peach orchard. There's a famous episode about his stealing. So, and his mother all the time was seeing this and very troubled. She was a woman of simple Christian faith. Not philosophical, simple Christian faith. And what she saw in her husband and in her son troubled her greatly. And she prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed about him for years. Okay, so his sinning went on. He was a lively sinner. In his young days, he was a lively sinner. You've heard Hank Williams songs. Well, it's a bit like that. It reminds me of that, actually. I keep thinking of Hank Williams when I read about Augustine. And I read a passage from him to that effect in a minute.
Hank or Augustine?
Both. Yeah. So he was a lively sinner. He says this. And it does sound like a Hank Williams song. I carried inside myself a cut and bleeding soul. And how to get rid of it, I just didn't know. I sought every pleasure. The countryside, sports, fooling around, the peace of a garden, friends and good company, sex, reading. My soul floundered in the void and came back upon me. And where could my heart flee from my heart? Where could I escape from myself? That's a man in agony. That's a man in a cage. Right? That's a troubled man. And that's all of us. That's all of us. That's straight from the Confessions. He's crying out. And when he writes the Confessions, he's writing it. He's already been converted. He was converted when he was 32 years old. He's writing the Confessions in his early 40s. He's reflecting on his sinful youth. And when he's writing about himself, he'll write a bit about himself in some episode in his younger days, and then he'll pray. And you'll see the prayer in the Confession, constant praying, talking about. So he's talking to himself about himself, and he's talking to the Lord in the Confessions, back and forth. There's constant business going on here. How the Lord's pulling him out of this business. But that's the Confessions. In his early 40s, he went on, he wrote many works. He wrote an incredible work on the Trinity. We're not going to talk about that today, but the other great work, this earlier work was in response to himself, an autobiographical work, the Confessions. Something happened when Augustine was older that shook the Roman world like nothing had shook it before. Now we're in the empire. In fact, we're in the latter stage of the empire, right? And things are not going so well. But still, the expectation in people's minds, just like us today, is that things will rock along in America, and things will be pretty much like they have been. Guess what? Things change. And they hit you broadside, they hit you blindsided. And you may think that today, in March of 2021, may be a very different story by June of 2021. That's how rapidly things are deteriorating and moving. Augustine's living in a world very much like ours, in a way. It's very interesting. Now, what happened? What happened that shook the Roman world? Was Rome, the city of Rome, which was supposed to be the eternal city, the city that never dies, was sacked, invaded, and sacked, and violated, and butchered in the year 410. 410. And these are Augustine's dates, by the way. He lived to the ripe old age of 75. But in the year 410, when he's an older man, Rome is sacked by the Visigoths, a Germanic tribe coming out of Central Europe under the king Alaric I. They sacked Rome. That's an amazing shock to the mind of Romans. This has never happened before. Rome's supposed to be inviolate. Can't touch it. The legions are out there. You're not going to get through, but it happened because of internal decay and a complex business going on there. It happened. This shook the world. A lot of the older, sort of traditional Roman pagans said, you know why this happened? I'll tell you why it happened. Because a few years ago, you let these Christians take over this polity. You let the Christians take over this polity. Because they did. Back in 380, Rome became officially Christian. And the Christians started shutting down the worship of pagan deities. And the pagans reacted to this sacking of Rome. 30 years later, they said, that's why. Because you let these Christians run things, and now our gods are angry, and so Rome gets sacked. Augustine says, oh, really? Really? So he rises to the occasion and says, that's not what happened. That's not what happened. And so the City of God, a lengthy treatise, is addressing these claims, this attack on Christianity. Systematically addresses it, saying, no, you can't lay this on the Christians. You can't lay this at our doorstep. It's because of stuff that you folk are doing. And by the way, your old pagan divinities are demons. And that's part of the City of God. And I'll show you how they are. And I'll show you what they did. And you may have to remember, Augustine's a Roman. Augustine's a Roman. When you read Wikipedia nonsense about this, oh, great, but evil philosopher. Really? Born in Roman times. He died before the fall of the Western Empire, 476. He's a Roman. His father's a Roman official. He's a Roman. In fact, he's a patriotic Roman. And some of his great loves are Roman writings. He's a Roman. But he's a Christian Roman, and he's going to defend Christianity. And so we'll talk about a couple of his loves as he came up. He's going to take up this challenge from the pagans. And he does that in the City of God. But I have to backpedal a little bit and talk about Augustine himself before I go into the particular topic. What kind of man was he? Why was he so troubled in certain ways? And his mother chased after him, saying, son, I pray for you. He wasn't a simple fellow. He was an extraordinary fellow with extraordinary gifts. And this is where I go back to two of his early influences as a young man. One of those influences was the Roman orator and philosopher Cicero. Tully Cicero. Can't go too far into the bushes talking about Cicero, but he was an enormously important Roman, influential down to our time. Cicero wrote a work, a dialogue that was lost. It was lost in the late empire. We don't have it now. Called the Hortensius. And it was a dialogue about how if you really love the truth, and this is a philosopher talking, and he's prejudiced in this sense, if you really love the truth, you have to get into philosophy. Now, there's a whole speech to be made about that, and I don't exactly agree with it. If you're a philosopher and you're a Christian, you will get into philosophy. I'll say that. But that's not to say that every Christian has to be a philosopher or do philosophy. That's certainly not the case. But Cicero wrote a piece that was very much saying philosophy is extremely important if you want to get into the nature of things. It is in that sense, right? What is philosophy? My definition is inquiry into the nature of ultimate reality. And that leads you, obviously, to God and creation, right? If you're going to be a true philosopher. Anyway, Cicero is very important. The other great influence was Virgil and his Aeneid, which is really the patriotic story written early in the early empire, Virgil's Aeneid. This is the patriotic story about the founding of Rome, coming out of Troy with Aeneas, right? And it's really a propaganda piece, in a way, against the Greeks, who were seen by the Romans as effeminate and corrupt and dubious and questionable. And it's a Roman patriot piece, right? And again, I say Augustine was very much a patriotic Roman in this way. Anyway, two early influences. Later influences, and Augustine, the young man, is enamored of philosophy. His mother's sitting there, and she doesn't really get it. She says, oh, boy, why are you getting into all this stuff? You know, you're getting into this odd religion called the Manichaeans, which is it was a very widespread religion at the time. The Manichaean religion spread all the way from the Roman Empire all the way to the coast of China, which is extraordinary. At its height, we don't even hear any there are no Manichaean churches down the street here right now, right? There's no Manichaean denomination in America, right? But Manichaeans back then were very widespread all over the place, going from Spain to China. And you say, well, how could that attract people? What was so attractive about it? It had a philosophy of good and evil. You had the main deity was a deity of good, and the lesser one, which was the sort of the subversive one, was the deity of darkness or evil associated with matter, which is again associated with Gnosticism and the negative view of matter. It gets complicated, but it's a sort of a dualism of good and evil. A dumbed down version of it might be Star Wars, right? You got the force of light and the force of darkness, and you got the Vader and you got the Luke Skywalker. That's a dumbed down version of Manichaeanism. In other words, there's no one force, as in true Christianity, that can explain the whole, right? God, true God, allows evil to work good. And evil is not a force set apart from God in the Christian framework that is somehow dueling with God. Evil is subordinate and plays a role dictated by the good and is, in a sense, part of the good. That's the true Christian view. Augustine had not come to this understanding yet. He was beating around trying to find a satisfying worldview in philosophy as a young man. He went to Manichaeanism. He probed into that. He met one of the gurus of Manichaeanism, and he questioned him, and the guy was just not up to the task of satisfying a rigorous mind like Augustine. So Augustine dumped him. He said, you can't explain the nature of evil satisfactorily, right? You can't do it. And so he lost heart with Manichaeanism. Well, next he went to the Platonist. And he found more satisfaction there, reading Plato and so forth. And then there was the last of the great Neoplatonists, pagan, not Christian, was a man called Plotinus, who wrote in the century prior a work called Aeneids. And that was more satisfactory, but still there were things grabbing at him. He went, as a young man, to Milan, Italy, North Italy, went to school and was under the bishop of Milan, who was Ambrose, the famous Christian who, by the way, he was busy fighting the Arian heresy at the time. Augustine saw all this and he listened to Ambrose, and he had already been converted, and he said, that's right, that's right, that's right. So he was putting all this together. His mother's wondering, what's going on with him? So bit by bit, he's finding his way to a solid worldview with Platonism and Christianity and so forth. So there he arrives. So there's a sense in which if Aquinas is Aristotelian, Augustine is a Platonist. There's an interesting sense there. Anyway, we're going to dive down into the particular subject here, and I've waited far too long to do it, and I've got to get going. The particular subject is what happened to our faculties as of the fall of man. Now, James Charles Ryle, in the 19th century, English bishop, evangelical bishop, again, another bishop. We've got bishops all over the place, Ambrose, Augustine, and now Ryle, of the Anglican Church. This is when the Anglicans were still Christian, evangelical. This is Bishop Ryle. He has a quotation, a wonderful quotation, in the book about Calvinism, where he says this, and this is central. He says, "There are very few errors in false doctrines of which the beginning may not be traced up to unsound views about the corruption of human nature." And this is on your sheet. "Wrong views of a disease will always bring wrong views of the remedy. Wrong views of the corruption of human nature will always carry with them wrong views of the grand antidote and cure of that corruption." Now, Bishop Rowe, I would recap that by saying most error and false doctrine, period, that we encounter in earthly life stems ultimately from a failure to acknowledge and understand the fall of man and the fall of the world with him. That's a big statement. That's a huge statement. That when I first read that quotation, I thought, there it is. Somebody absolutely nailed the thing. That is so true. I've encountered that in political philosophy and in other fields, and that is a central truth. That whenever you hear somebody babbling on in a silly way in whatever field, oftentimes you can trace it back to a failure to understand and appreciate what happened to man as of the fall. That's often, very often the case. Well, that begs the question, what was human nature like before the fall? And we have to go back to Scripture, of course. Psalm 46:8 says, "Come and see the works of the Lord, the wonders he has placed on earth." Ecclesiastes 7:29 says, "God made man upright, possessed of a good will." A good will. He was made upright. Augustine says, "God made man in his own image by creating for him a soul of such a kind that because of it, he surpassed all living creatures on earth, in the sea, and in the sky." Why? And this is the key. "In virtue of his reason and intelligence, for no other creature had a mind like that." No other creature had a mind like that. Freedom of the will, reason, intelligence, human dignity, by the virtue of being given the image of God. No other creature had a mind like that. There it is. We're going to dig into that and talk about that reason, intelligence, and what it consists of. Goodwill. What about the will? We'll talk a lot about the will. Goodwill, then, is the work of God since man was created with it. Now, an interesting aside, and this gets back to both Augustine and Aristotle. God loves himself, right? Why wouldn't he? He's perfect. He's perfectly good. We think about that. God naturally loves himself. And part of us, with our sin nature, said, "Ooh, I don't know if it's good to love yourself." Well, God has reason to love himself. We don't. God has reason to love himself because he's perfect and perfectly good. So the question comes up, with original man, before the fall, what did God love about man? What did he love about man? Well, he loved most about man, what was best about man, which was his own image in man. Stands to reason, doesn't it? Stands to reason. Well, what would that be? And this is where I'll just bring in a little taste of Aristotle, because I think that here in the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle had anticipated some of this. Aristotle says this, and he's speaking in the old polytheistic frame, but still, the truth is there. "A man whose activity is guided by intelligence, and he keeps That intelligence in the best condition seems to be the most beloved by the gods. Also, the gods love most in man, reason and intelligence, that which is most like themselves. That core. What is the core in man that God loves most? There it is. Okay, now what does that involve? There's a great deal there that we'll unpack in a minute. But before we go on to that, and why, we just talked about what God loves in man, specifically in the image before it was broken by man's fall. There's another part of it. And this is where the focus is on that one man, Adam. Why God created humanity through the one man. What was the intention there? And this is where we'll go talk about the planned unity of the human race and how it was shattered by the fall. And how the hope had been with creation, the hope had been that there would be a unity because all descended from one. The many came from one. Augustine says this, man was created as one individual. In other words, God didn't make a bunch of individuals. He made one. He made one. Extraordinary. He does the best things in the best way. And this must have been the best way since the best one did it. Right? He didn't make a bunch of different people, like 50 of them or 100 to 5,000. He made one. There's a reason he did it the way he did it. And last week we talked about that. He does things in the best possible way. Why? Man was created as one individual but was not left alone. For the human race is, more than any other species, at once social by nature and quarrelsome by perversion, by virtue of the fall. Another big insight. Social by nature, he made us before the fall, but what? Quarrelsome by perversion through the fall. That's a huge, political philosophers just sit up and perk up when they hear that, like, you just unraveled the mystery of the Sith there. What did you do? That's a key insight. That's a tremendous insight. Social by nature, as made in the original, but quarrelsome by perversion from the fall. That's another one you need to perk up out there. But again, many from one. Although God fashioned man from the dust of the earth, Augustine says, the earth itself and all earthly matter are derived from nothing at all. So, we know that Adam came from dust, but the dust itself came from nothing. Creation ex nihilo. Not only his body came ex nihilo, but his soul did too. It's hard to wrap your mind around that. All right? We can't make a soul or anything else ex nihilo. How was that done? Okay, we can ponder it. We can scratch our heads about it. Amazing. Extraordinary. All right? How was that done? Again, men whose race was derived from a single ancestor, a fact that was intended to foster harmony, by the way. It was intended to foster harmony. And also, the fact that a woman was made for the first man from his own side, his rib, shows us clearly how affectionate should be the union of man and wife. So again, unity was intended by making all from the one. That was the intention, but things went awry as of the fall. The image of man was broken by man himself by the fall. The fall was a separate question in how it came into being, but right now we're going to deal with the damage. We're all damaged goods. We're all damaged goods, seriously damaged goods. And we don't even realize it sometimes. Unbelievers don't realize they're damaged goods. That's a sign of believers. The believer understands, yeah, I'm damaged goods, I'm seriously damaged goods. But then by the time you come to the recognition that you're damaged goods, you're not as damaged as you were before. It's the paradox of that, right? Because you're already on the road to getting some regeneration, right? That's the interesting thing about it. Epistemological polylogism. Won't get into all that, but it changes perspective. What happened to us specifically? What happened to our faculties? When man fell, two cities emerged. the city of God, the city of man, the city of those who would follow the Lord in obedience and who would need healing and get healing, and then those who were oblivious, who were in rebellion, metaphysical rebellion against God and His creation, who would be at war with the followers of God through the earthly times. All. We always have to remember, we're at war. We're at war. As long as we're in earthly life, we're at war. But God knew, of course, before man fell, that He would work all evil to good. What about the damage to the particular faculties? I'm going to use the terminology of carnal faculties, fleshly faculties on the one hand. By that I mean unregenerate faculties on the one hand and regenerate faculties on the other. What are our faculties? Immanuel Kant used to be mocked for saying he's always beating the bushes like an old man out there in Königsberg, Germany, looking for another faculty. Where is it? Is it under that bush and all that? He was mocked for doing that because he claimed to discover some aspects about human nature that hadn't been discovered before. What about these powers? When I say faculties, I mean powers of man in his mind and in his soul. The first, we think of the emotion, right? The emotion. The ancients defined emotions as movements of the soul. And in fact, that's literally what that means. We go back to the Latin. It means to move out. Ex moho. It means those things that move out of us. The passions, the emotions, and so forth. Okay? We'll talk about reason, imagination, memory, and most of all, will. When we get down to will. What happened to these? All of these have carnal forms, and all of them have regenerate forms. That's the point. And they behave differently according to which condition they're in. Just as an overview before we dive into the particulars, I'll just say this. Carnal faculties. How do you know that a person has carnal faculties? I mean, we always have admixtures, right? The flesh is with us even as believers. So sometimes we're carnal in our operations. But on the whole, a believer is oriented a different way. So it gets a little complicated sometimes. You get some mixed bag. How do you know carnal faculties when you see them? How do you know a person who has carnal faculties, pretty much purely carnal faculties when you see them, when you hear them, when you see them on the news or when you whatever? How do you know that? They operate pridefully and ignorant of their own limitations. The telltale sign is they don't have humility about the limitations of their different faculties. They think they can just do anything. Anything. Go anywhere. No humility. No sense of limits. No sense of limits in relation to a God who is tremendously grander and better. Driven by a narrow love of self. That's another telltale sign. Driven by a narrow love of self. The corrupt heart skews all the mind's operations, whatever they may be. A corrupt heart skews them all. How? Towards erroneous perspectives and sinful designs. They always tend to view some favored part of reality as the whole of reality. So I've just given you several telltale trademarks of carnal reason. They view the part as a whole. They get it wrong. Right? They have no sense of limit in what they think they can do. They think that whatever they feel and think has got to be true. It's got to be true. And there are no limits. And no one's going to tell them otherwise. That's the tendency. Regenerate faculties, on the other hand, operate humbly, circumspectly, carefully, ever conscious of their own limitations and liability to error, driven by the love of truth, not by narrow love of self, but driven by the love of truth, the regenerate heart commands the mind's faculties towards seeing the whole of reality, God and creation, as rightly as possible with all due humility, recognizing their limits, great limits, to what we can fathom, what we can see. Just a basic overview. What about the emotions? With the fall of man, what happened to man's emotions, this faculty? What happened? again, this is something I have to emphasize. We're in a condition where we think that that's all there is. And we think, well, we're not so bad off. I mean, we can do things. I can operate a motor vehicle, and I can do a job at work, and I can go take care of the lawn, and I can fix a lawnmower. I can do things. What's so bad about that? What's so bad about my fallen condition? You see people who are unbelievers doing all kinds of things. That's true. Up to a point. The Lord allows that up to a point. So we tend to get into the mindset that, these Christians talk about our being fallen and damaged, but no, things seem not so bad to us. They don't get it. They don't really understand what's going on. So what's going on here? What happened to man's emotions? Man, after the fall, was distracted and tossed about by violent and conflicting emotions, a very different thing from what he was in paradise before his sin, even though then he lived in an animal body. Adam lived in an animal body, a fleshly body, right? But he didn't behave like Harvey Weinstein, or Cuomo up in New York, and so forth. He just didn't. Or any other number of people you'd like to name. He just didn't. Something was different. His soul was ordered and orderly in a way it's hard for us to even fathom how that could be. Right? We don't know how bad off we are is the point. We're damaged goods, and we don't know we're damaged goods before we're regenerate. What an interesting situation. The emotions are all awry. I guess the core would be this. I used to teach logic, and there was a particular fallacy in logic class called the emotive fallacy. And it goes like this. A person who reasons in this way, I want X to be the case, therefore X is the case. Premise and conclusion. Sound familiar? That's called the emotive fallacy. It's a false way of reasoning. Here it is again. I want X to be the case, therefore X is the case. Conversely, I don't want X to be the case, therefore X is not the case. Sound familiar? We do that all the time, don't we? Unregenerate people, that's their modus operandi. That's what they live by. I want X to be the case, therefore X is the case. They're making a broad metaphysical claim based on what they want, what they feel. I feel that X is true, therefore X is true. I believe that the moon is made out of cheese, therefore the moon is made out of cheese. And don't argue with me about it, or we'll send the FBI to pick you up, right? That's what it's getting to, isn't it? That's what we're coming to. Sounds absurd, right? But that's really what we're coming to. That's carnal emotion. That's raw carnal emotion. Don't dare disagree with my feelings or there'll be repercussions. You'll pay for it. I'll punish you. I'll use the power of the state to crush you. What happened to reason? What is reason, anyway? Reason's a lot of things. Reason is causal. The ability of the human mind to think in terms of cause and effect. If I go out and I'm trying to cut my grass and I can't get this thinking lawnmower started, a perennial problem sometimes, right? Especially when it's hot, right? And my arm's hurting and I got to pull, crank. I can only do so many and I'm this stupid thing, you kick it. Other things happen too. Verbal things. But anyway, things happen. And I think, why isn't this thing starting? Is it carbon buildup on the spark plug? Is it this? Is it gas? Is it what? Is it the way the stars are aligned or what? I don't know. But I need to cut the grass and the stinking thing won't start. So cause and effect. I've got to learn. I've got to get it right. Cause and effect. I've got to reason about it. Just calm down. Think about it. Think it through. Don't get upset. All right. Cause and effect. Reasoning. Okay. Also, it's about perceiving things. Like there's a dog here and there's a dog here. And I form the concept dog. Concept formation. Perception. Sensation. The interesting thing about the fall of man and what happened to reason is it didn't seem to have affected the lower aspects of reason, like the fact that I can form the concept green from different green things, right? I can take, this is like this, and I can form this abstract concept green. That thing's green, that thing's. I can talk about properties, right? I can talk about red, And I could form concepts from particular red or green things, and I could form the concept red and green, or I can see particular dogs as opposed to cats who have different properties, and I can form the concept dog, and I can get more and more abstract and universal as I come all the way up with just being qua being, boom, philosophical metaphysics, right? I go from concrete particulars I observe and sense, hot and cold, all right, the eye on stove, cube of ice, and I can form the concept hot, cold, and get more and more abstract. That's reason building up from the concrete that we sense to figures. Interestingly enough, the fall didn't seem to affect stuff at the lower level, but it very definitely affected the more abstract things. It very definitely affected those. What happened to reason? I can give you examples in political philosophy or other things of bad reasoning and good reasoning. Michael Oakeshott, English political philosopher, who was so tired of refuting bad political philosophers who kept saying that liberty has no connection to virtue. He threw his hands up and said, listen, you guys are never going to get this because you don't believe in God. Because your reasoning faculty is unregenerate. You don't see that there are causes that are first causes, i.e. God. And then there's the end of it all, which is, again, God, who's the end or the aim in his goodness. You, what you do, you bad carnal reasoners, you just wallow in the intermediate causes endlessly. Right? Right? That's what Richard Dawkins does. He wallows endlessly, the evolutionist, right? Oh, but what about the snail darter? All this. They get muddle-headed and get stupid by wallowing in intermediate causes, and ultimately they can't even explain those phenomena because they don't have the beginning cause and the end effect and cause. They can't root things correctly because they don't believe. They haven't been given to believe by faith and grace. And so they get it wrong. That's what happened to reason. What about imagination? What is imagination? What is imagination? Very simple illustration. What's a unicorn? It's a combination. Do unicorns really exist? I'm sure some liberals will say that. Among sane people, do unicorns really exist? The answer is no, or it used to be no, right? When 2 + 2 = 4, right? It was no. Unicorns are combinations of horses and horns, in the same way that fawns in mythology are combinations of goats and humans, in the same way that Superman is not real, right? He's just a man. We took the concept man from a real man and gave it superhuman strength, and that's how we found the concept of Superman. We made him a costume that's nice, and he looks American, red and blue, and all that stuff, right? The cape, right? And the phone booth he shoots out of, okay? And no more phone booths, so he's going to go to a smartphone or something. anyway, we know about imagination, right? Now, imagination can be corrupted, case in point. Carnal imagination does wicked things. The book of Jude tells us that, right? Remember it talks about those filthy dreams, those filthy imaginings? I can give you many examples of filthy imaginings. The Marquis de Sade, you've heard of the Marquis de Sade? Where the word sadism comes from him, the French Marquis coming out of the French Revolution. He wrote a treatise on the, and he wrote a sympathetic treatise on the most wicked sexual things imaginable, and praise them. A man who sits down to write a treatise on that sort of thing. Okay? More recently, we have Miss J.K. Rowling with her Harry Potter business. And people say, oh, don't pick on Harry Potter. It's just innocent fun and all this. Well, really? Well, in there, and Trent preached on this a few days ago for us, how we're not to dabble in the occult. And we know from the book of Acts that the books of magic are burned, righteously burned. We're not to dabble in the occult. It is out of bounds for us as humans. But J.K. Rowling thinks it's okay, it's innocent fun. And her books have the effect of seducing and attracting young children into magic and the occult. They do. They do. Against that, that's carnal imagination at work. Very imaginative. but carnal and wicked, with a wicked end. Compare that to Tolkien for Lewis. What was the real goal of the Lord of the Rings? If we had Tolkien here right now, if we had C.S. Lewis right here, we talked about Narnia, and I asked him, what was your goal here? You've written tales of great imagination that attract children and others. What was your goal? He would say, to bring them to the Lord. That is regenerate imagination. How different. See their ultimate ends? Rolling versus Tolkien. And here we are again. What about memory? You say, well, memory seems innocent. Either you remember something or you don't. Not really. What's memory? Memnos. What is memory? Well, carnal memory. What does carnal memory look like? How does it operate? Carnal memory wants to erase or falsely rewrite the past. To what end? To what end? To deny providence. To deny the glorious workings of the Lord. Now, really? How did you trace that out? Augustine does. Carnal memory is all about denying glory to the Lord. The evolutionists do that. They don't deny glory of creation, don't they? God didn't do it. It just happened from old protoplasm, from slime somewhere, just spontaneously evolved. Never mind about where the slime came from. Never mind that we use natural causes to explain natural causes. Naturalism refutes itself. But anyway, carnal memory wants to either erase, like Orwell's 1984, it didn't happen. George Washington didn't exist. If we give these people in our country long enough, they will say George Washington never existed. He said, that's crazy. Well, they're moving that direction, aren't they? Right now he's wicked. He's this wicked slave holder. Before long he just won't exist at all. At this rate, right? That's the direction it's heading in, isn't it? We either rewrite, we falsify to deny God's glory and goodness, or we just erase it, period. Like Orwell. That's where we're heading. That's carnal memory. What about sound memory, regenerate memory? How does it operate? Sound memory wants to accurately remember and learn from the past, and by that I mean providence. John Flavel, God bless him, wonderful work, Puritan writer, right? Talks about providence. And every page he's saying, as a Christian, you need to remember the blessings that have been bestowed upon you. Don't forget those things that have happened in your life and give God the credit for it. That's memory. That's memory. Don't forget. Because if you forget, it's a sin. You're being ungracious. You're being ungrateful. I forgot. The Lord did things for me. He pulled me out of that burning car when I was 16. Whatever. I forgot about it. Blithely forgot about it. Forgot giving thanks for it. I forget the blessings. Bad carnal memory. Right? As opposed to, I remember he did that. He's really helped me. He's really done things for me. He's really brought me along. Right? That's good memory. Now, the biggest one, and there are different aspects of this. Notice how military victors tend to write the histories? This is an example of carnal memory. Cultural Marxists want to add context to our monuments. You know that? We can't just say George Washington, so-and-so, and so-and-so. We have to have their context because they're going to teach us about heroes, right? You think so? Leftists threatening to kidnap and re-educate children of Trump voters. That happened right after the election, didn't it? You hear those threatenings? We're going to take your children. You're irresponsible. You homeschool. We can't have that. No independent thought allowed. No Christian thought specifically allowed. All right? We're going to take your children, re-educate them, a la what happened in Cambodia, and so forth. That's what we're going to do. Now, leftists dismiss dissent as misinformation and conspiracy theory. We hear that all the time. right? There's a fight over who writes the history, right? There's a fight over who controls memory, collective memory. There's a war. It's carnal memory, carnal memories versus sound memories. And we've got to remember the true history in order to be grateful. At the core of all this is the ruling faculty according to Augustine. This is the ruling faculty. And this is the will. What is the will? It's the power to choose between good and evil. That's the will. And there are lots of quotations about the will. I come out with God created man's good, but with a free will. The value of man would be less without free will. We experience our willing or choosing as free. God is ultimately sovereign over our willing, but we experience our willing as free. And if we didn't have that will and the dignity of that will, we wouldn't be as valuable creatures as we are. We would just be automatons. So will is central. Will is the central faculty that determines the operation of all the others in some sense. Decision between good and evil. Now, when we're fallen, we're non posta non peccata. We're not able to not sin. We're stuck. Everything we feel, think, and do is sinful. Before we're regenerate, an amazing situation. Everything. I don't care how nice a person seems who's lost. You say, that's an outrageous claim, Winston. Why are you saying that? I know some nice people who aren't believers. Really? Nice. Nice. Nice is not good, though. Right? Yeah, they obey the law because they're afraid of punishment, right? Of course they do. But what's going on with them? Not able to not sin. Constantly sinning in thought, word, and deed without interruption. Non posta non peccata. That's their situation unless they've been regenerate. Right? They can't be otherwise. They're locked in because of the fall of man. Only God, through grace, can bring them out of it. Right? So there we go. What's behind all this? What's behind? What's driving all this stuff? What's the ultimate goal of the carnal faculties? That's the question that kept coming up in my mind. What's the ultimate goal? I think there's an agenda. You said, ooh, this sounds strange, like a conspiracy theory. Well, in a way it is. Proverbs 1:11 says this, and these are the bad guys talking. They say this, let us hide the righteous man in the earth unrighteously. Let us act the part of hell and swallow him up alive. And let us sweep away his memory from the earth and get hold of his valuable property. In other words, let's wipe out knowledge of God and take his stuff. Take his people, take his churches, take his stuff, take his property. Sounds like the vineyard business. Take it. Take it. Murder his son. Take his property. It's ours. The earth is ours. That's it. Forces of Mordor. Coming on. Here we go. Matthew 24 says this, though. And this is where G.K. Chesterton writes in The Everlasting Man. He says, oh, but this is all futile, according to God's plan. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. All this fantasy of the carnal faculties is to no avail, ultimately. It goes nowhere. So do not be afraid of them, for there is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. They have their fantasies, these carnal unbelievers. But that's it. Now, I promised Trent I would talk about a modern-day Augustinian, and I'll do that. There's another, you know, we could talk a lot about social by nature and quarrelsome by the first of the fall. That's for another day. But here it is. Trent was asking me about, I think some folks were talking to him about aliens and the structure of our known universe, physical known universe. Interesting question. Right, and all that sort of thing. There's a man who is from Weaverville, North Carolina, in the mountains. I love him. He's a great writer. His name is Richard Weaver. He was a professor of rhetoric at the University of Chicago, born in 1910, died suddenly in a car accident in 1963. Great loss. Wrote some wonderful essays about the South. He was a rhetorician, philosopher. Wonderful writings, and he wrote a book called Visions of Order. He's a lover of Augustine. And in Visions of Order, he wrote a book, an essay called The Reconsideration of Man. And there he's basically saying, you know, for generations now, there have been people, intellectuals, trying to tear man down, to deny that God's image is in man, to devalue man, to strip him of freedom of the will, to strip him of his God-given dignity as the height of creation and the center. And there are two basic forces at work. The evolutionists, of course, we've mentioned, who, according to their rendition of things, all causes are merely natural causes, and they ultimately contradict themselves about that. But they want to, the result or the impact of their ideas on human societies since they've been around has been to diminish the value of man by saying, oh, he's just another one of these evolved creatures, like a toad or anything else. There's nothing special about him. There's nothing special here. Don't look here, right? Devaluing. The other one was, and this was not deliberate, but it had the impact, the idea of a heliocentric solar system, okay, that came along with the Copernican Revolution 4 centuries ago. Prior to that, the common view had been that the Earth is the center of the solar system. The sun and everything else rotate around it, geocentric, right? That's a false view. We know it's a false view. It had been widely embraced and embraced by people in the church until it came to be associated with people in the church. So the smart secular people came along and said, aha, you're wrong about this. Aha! So they kept just like latched on this. Oh, you Christians are so ignorant, stupid. Look at you. Look at this. You're wrong. Geocentrism is not a necessary part of Christian faith. It just happens to be a scientific theory that happened to have been discovered to be wrong. Fine. Whatever. Heliocentrism is true. The sun's at the center of the solar system and so forth, right? What about these, right? Well, the notion, again, was that this devalues man somehow. Man is not at the center because Earth is not at the center, either the solar system or the universe. And so the implication, the suggestion was that, oh, this devalues man. He's not at the physical center anymore. Weaver says this in response to both of these beautiful quotations. He says this, and I'll finish. If one planet supports life and a whole galaxy supports none, there's nothing to give the galaxy greater value or significance. It is conceivable that the Creator made for man a small and somewhat out-of-the-way pasture. Remember Bethlehem? It was a small and out-of-the-way town, away from Rome, away from Jerusalem. Humble origins, humble family. Rings true. A small and out-of-the-way pasture, but what? Earth is a very green and very adequate for his means, for his needs. Much of the universe might seem a waste of matter to these secularists. He's got this big universe. Where's the other life? Right? Where's Jabba the Hutt? He's out there somewhere. Right? He's out there. Where's Coruscant? The city that's nothing but city. Or the planet that's nothing but city. What a dreary place out here, right? God, stay away from that, right? Cities are bad enough, but a whole planet, a city? Ugh, horrible. What a horror story. Not for some people. Much of the universe might seem a waste of matter, but what is the meaning here of waste? Waste has no meaning where matter can be created ex nihilo, out of nothing. God makes it the way he wants to make it. And it's the best possible way. And he wants to make billions of planets and billions of stars with one green planet. That's his business. And where he physically locates them and all that. And we don't know all of that, by the way. It's his business. And it's all for the best. Questions, comments? I've gone a little late. Sorry.
Have you ever used that idea, to some Christians and certainly to unbelievers, that sounds simply like, well, because God says so. I wouldn't dispute that that's sufficient for the faithful to receive as a justification, but do you think there's some truth to that, that it's simply a matter of faith?
He literally said so, didn't he? Because he spoke it into existence. which is interesting. Which, but they're not going to, if they're unbelievers, it's like that quotation I gave you from Thomas last week. He said, no amount of persuading is going to persuade people who are not given to believe. And for one who already believes, no amount of arguments needed to persuade them. That's called epistemological polylogism, a big fancy philosophical term that means if the believer is then in this box here, the unbeliever is over here, the believer's been given to see certain things first and final causes, the unbeliever, no matter what you say to them, no matter what you say to them, I don't care how great your demonstrations are, you can trot out all the Augustine, Aquinas, and scripture you want to, they're not going to accept it. They're not going to see it. And here we are in the same polities together. It's a war. You can pity them, but also you got to live with them. And they're going to try to tyrannize over you because of their corrupt faculties. The tendency is to, their faculties is to tyrannize and to control, and that's exactly what they're doing now. That's all they know, and they think it's good. They think it's good. They think it is the good. Shall we close in prayer? Dear Lord, thank you for this hour. Thank you for putting us into the box, so to speak, of believers, so that we can appreciate and better understand ourselves and the image you put in us, but also to have due humility about those powers, to look to you to repair us, to heal us. We are damaged goods in need of repair. We look to you . Everything good comes from you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.